spring? Is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. That means more comfort and less baggage. Experience how Allbirds is redefining comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.
The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
I always look about, you know, teams who've won a league, their mindsets, their body language, their hunger, desire. And I see that so much in this Liverpool team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Rory McIlroy's game has changed a lot.
The OTB Brief, weekday mornings from 7:20 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, welcome back. So we are reviewing the Sunday Papers. We have George Hamilton with us, RTE commentator extraordinaire. We have Tommy Martin as well, anchor at Virgin Media's football coverage. I'll run you through the headlines first of all. Leinster leave it late is the lead in the Mail on Sunday. Picture Jordan Larmour punching the air. Munster 10, Leinster 13. Jordan Larmour celebrating his late try to win the game for Leinster. And then beneath that, it's Shane McGrath in the Mail on Sunday here. Cautious reopening raises questions for sport. This is on the back of Neil Martin's interview yesterday with Brendan O'Connor, which, if you heard, had a few chilly moments, was not the most optimistic of pictures being painted. It won't surprise you, I'm sure, but the Taoiseach admitted significant restrictions will remain in place for at least the first half of the year. So Shane McGrath makes the point here that that will have knock-on effects on any hopes of fans returning to Irish stadia in any significant numbers in 2021. It is the news that Irish sporting bodies had been fearing, says Shane. The Observer is next here in front of me. Heartbreakers. This is Cheltenham yesterday in the FA Cup. Cheltenham's Alfie May threatens a major shock, but late goals from Foden, Jesus and Torres secure a 3-1 win for Manchester City. Picture there of Man City players celebrating Torres's goal. Sunday Independent then. They go with Jordan Larmour about to score his try. Larmour's killer blow, and then Brendan Fanning writing the match report here. Brendan will be on with us around 3 o'clock with Matt Williams. Hugo Keenan shines as Ireland coach sees plenty of reasons to be cheerful at Thomond Park. Beneath that, if you hadn't seen it, Arsenal, the holders bow out as City survive Cheltenham's scare. Sunday Times, a similar picture to the Mail on Sunday of Jordan Larmour. Joy for Jordan. Late Larmour try hands Leinster win at Munster. And then Frank Lampard, Chelsea in action at the moment in the FA Cup against Luton. They're currently 2-1 up. Lampard tells squad, run or you don't play. So Frank Lampard reckons it's pretty simple right now. Chelsea work rate is their biggest issue. So run or you don't play is his message. Sunday Mirror Sport, building up to Manchester United Liverpool in the FA Cup this evening. Klopp cop out. Pool boss hints that his long-term future is in doubt. I think the quote this is all based around, and it's in other places besides the Mirror. He said, short-term I'm quite easy to excite, but then in the long-term it's not easy. It's hard to know if we're reading too much into that, but a few of the papers had that interpretation at the press conference, so I guess there's something in it potentially. The Sun have a race for Deo Upamecano, who plays for Leipzig. By all accounts, a really good player. I haven't seen too much of him. I heard Didi Hamann talking about him, saying he was a really brilliant prospect, 22 years of age. So he's got a £38 million release clause, which can be activated in the summer. And it seems that for obvious reasons, both Manchester United and Liverpool are in the hunt. And then finally, Sunday World here. It's again building up to Manchester United-Liverpool in the FA Cup fourth round at 5 o'clock. Bruno Fernandes, brewing up a storm. Bruno has vowed to pile the misery on Liverpool. What he said was, if you want to win the cup, then you have to beat the biggest teams. So we have a chance now to beat one of the best teams left in the FA Cup. And then beneath that, Gooners are goners. Arsenal out of the FA Cup. Tommy Martin, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Joe.
Great to have you with us. Yeah, good. And George Hamilton, you're very welcome to the paper review.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Joe.
So, where will we start? I mean, there's lots going on, loads of good stuff in the papers, I think, today. Broad strokes, Tommy, we could have picked out another 5, 6, 7, 8 pieces to the ones we're going to try and get around to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a big theme around the horse racing stuff. There's a lot of Man U Liverpool stuff that's interesting because both clubs are poised in interesting places at the moment. And then there's other more individual stuff. There's a great Joe Brawley piece with Michael Darren McCauley, which I initially sort of brushed over, but you brought our attention to, and it's probably the piece I most enjoyed reading this morning. And then lots more nice Gerry Kiernan tributes as well.
I must say I was in danger of brushing by the Joe Brawley piece and Michael Darren McCauley as well until I saw Kieran Cunningham tweeting about it, and I thought, okay, I'll give that a look. He's a regular paper reviewer guest, and it didn't disappoint. George, did you get around to look at this? Joe Brawley talking about...
I'm so surprised at you that you don't read Joe Brawley every week.
No, I do. I like a spikier headline on my Brawley pieces before really grab
it. I might have passed it by because of the subject matter, because my eye was taken by all the UEFA stuff on this new European Super League and so on. And I got round to it, you know, mid-afternoon, feed up, cup of tea. Yeah. And then I'd read Joe Brawley. But because of this, I read it pretty, one of the first things I read. And I found it absolutely, as always with Joe, absolutely fascinating. Great piece. Just the whole business and how it started. We'll turn it up for an all-out final without your boots, you know. It seems so ludicrous. But then that's life. And Joe's very good at finding that kind of angle. And I think that he did it spot on. With that piece today.
This is on the back of Michael Darren McCauley, who has retired, of course. So I didn't realise Brawley and Michael Darren are obviously friendly and keep in touch. And it starts Crow Park, September 18th, 2011, 3:15. Pat Gilroy standing in the middle of the changing room. The boys are togged out, ready to go, etc. Suddenly Michael Darren McCauley, who's still in his trainers, catches Pat's eye and nodded him towards the toilets. Pat followed him in. What is it? I've forgotten my boots. F off, Michael. Seriously, I have. Jesus Christ, Michael, what size are you? 12. I'm 13, said Pat. They'll have to do you. And so he took Pat Gilroy's boots. I had never heard this story. I can't believe that. So he took Gilroy's boots and do not say a word to anyone, said Gilroy. The midfielder went on to put in, writes Brawley, a monumental performance at midfield as Dublin won their first All-Ireland in 16 years. As Gilroy later joked, it made no difference to him anyway, because in those days he never kicked a ball. And Tommy, what becomes apparent is that Gilroy and subsequent Dublin managers loved what Michael Darren brought to the equation. He was the keen man. He changed everything. His attitude was the spearhead of the transformation from losers to winners, said Gilroy. He was unbreakable. He ran at every bleep test. He trained like he played. He destroyed his markers with his stamina, his tackling, his quick hands, etc. Brawley has a brilliant line on Michael Darren. When he played, his limbs appeared to move independently of each other. Ungainly as a man running in water, his head waggling from side to side as though he were dodging punches. When he soloed, every other touch was a high catch. Yet, his was the very heart of the Dublin revival.
It's a brilliant description of him. And like it's the case with any good piece of writing that it immediately conjures the image of the person that's describing. And that was him. And yet, as you know, the piece, I actually was taken aback. The anecdotes about Michael Darren McCauley's, the stuff about the boots, and there's a great one to come to in a minute later on. But it's that bit you just read there about how Gilroy said he was the key man for the Dublin revival is a really extraordinary revealing thing for Gilroy to say, because that was such a seismic turnaround in a team's fortunes, and we're still, you know, a decade later, still being played out. So what a tribute to a guy's impact to have that. But then balance that with the fact that how completely nonplussed he was by his ability as a player, his importance to Dublin, by the whole game of Gaelic football. You know, Brawley says, successive Dublin managements realised early on that he didn't know anything about Gaelic football or footballers. Unless they were part of his group, he had no interest. Before they played Tyrone in April 2010, he was told he was marking Sean Kavanagh, and it quickly became apparent he had absolutely no idea who Sean Kavanagh was. And remember, this is April 2010 when Sean Kavanagh was a three-time All-Ireland winner by that stage, and I think possibly Footballer of the Year in 2008. So Ray Boyne, who was Gilroy's number two, sorry, Ray Boyne, who was doing the clips at the time, had to download images and say, this is Sean Kavanagh, this is who you're marking. But there's another anecdote then later on, a bit like the one about the boots. It's the Tuesday before the 2011 final. After the last training session, Gilroy has said to the lads, no golf, no runs, complete rest. Do nothing between now and Sunday. But as he was leaving Parnell Park, McCauley tapped Gilroy's window. What is it, Michael? Look, Pat, I have to play a basketball game on Saturday evening. You're joking me. No, it's a mate's game. We've only 10, so I have to play. I can't let them down. Gilroy says, I could just see he would be very upset if I said no. And I said, OK, just don't tell anyone, Michael. And that was Michael. But I think And then the killer line is when Gilroy gave him permission, McCauley said, thanks, Pat. I'm not really into the guy anyway. But the key is that, like, as a good manager, to manage the individual and not lay down the law, a blanket law across the whole squad. And obviously Gilroy had the intelligence to know that you manage McCauley in an individual way, the way he needed to be.
Yeah, there's a line in there as well. Joe's quoting Colm O'Rourke. They're talking about, would Michael Darragh be player of the year? And Colm O'Rourke said, it's a bit like the Kit Kat ad, you know, with that band. And the fella says, you can't play, you look awful, you'll go a long way.
Yeah.
And he did, and he has. And what a career.
Yeah, there's such
a career. But what about the end? What about the end of the story as well? His bike has been. Joe rings him up yesterday. He says to get a feel for his personality again as the piece is going in the paper. And there's noise in the background. He says, "Where are you?" He says, "I'm on the bike." He says, "Well, where are you?" "I'm riding around Stephen's Green. My bike was nicked, so I'm on a Dublin bike." he's getting his cycling in by hiring a Dublin bike and doing laps of Stephen's Green.
Yeah. How many have you done? A fair few. I hung up, as I always do, smiling and shaking my head, pointless trying to talk to him about football. And a bit like he is in the pitch, he seems to be all action as well. Like Brolly recounts a previous drink with him, having a pint with him, and Michael Darragh spent the whole hour stretching with using an umbrella to do it, you know, unselfconsciously stretching his back out at different points. So the whole thing is just, it's kind of Roy the Rovers, unconventional, romantic George, and these are all the things people are drawn to.
Absolutely. You couldn't fail to like Michael Darragh McCauley after reading that, because it's the swan. I mean, I'm just off the air with the music program and lyric and thinking, you know, the ugly duckling who turns into a swan. You know, this is Michael Darragh's football career, that it should never happen, but it did. Of course it did, because he was so good at what he did. Mm. And it's a great piece. And as I say, I'm surprised you didn't read Joe Brolly first, because he's such an important part of my Sunday reading.
Is that right? No, don't worry. We get to him. Every Sunday we get to him. It's more that it's such a lovely piece, and it's on the bottom of page 9. You'd very easily miss it, you know, because there's other very compelling pieces in the paper. It was almost that as much as anything. So you enjoy a Sunday sitting back with the papers, feet up, George, and reading about all sports?
I do. Anything at all. And I find that the paper, the Indo, I think, is a terrific sports section, and the Sunday Times too. And I get most of my value out of those, because those would be my two go-to of a regular Sunday. And I enjoy Tommy Conlon on the back page as well. I enjoy Tommy Conlon, sorry. I enjoy him and Sweeney on the back page. I got them mixed up there. Apologies, guys. Because they're two that I would also go to as well. And Kimmage, of course, is who we'll be talking about later on too. But I enjoy that. It's generally a walk, a big walk with the dogs and Jack Russell's, and then the papers at this time of the year. Of course, the afternoon's not so long. There's plenty of time to read before dinner.
And a snooze. Oh, it's nice, isn't it?
And the snooze is after dinner.
How come you've never commentated on GAA, or have I missed this somehow?
No. It just never kind of happened, because my contemporary is Ger Canning, of course, so we started off more or less at the same time, and he went down one track and I went down the other. And I suppose when we became established at what we did, you know, there wasn't really any room for me to go into the GAA. It's something I've followed and I'm interested in, and I've been to all Ireland finals and I've cheered on Down. That's a while ago. But it just never kind of happened. But I did. One of my favourite memories is actually being the match day reporter with the Antrim hurling team in 1989. when I met up with them in Casement Park on the Friday night, and I followed them down on the Saturday, and I was with them before and after on the Sunday, and at the post-match dinner in Malahide, and spent half the game beside big Niall Patterson in the Antrim goal as Tipperary bore down on him again and again and again. But that was one of my favourite memories of the Antrim. Great guys, that Antrim hurling team, who just couldn't believe what they got to the All-Ireland, and were in no way upset that Tipperary became the champions.
Yes. To jump to page 11 of the Sunday Independent, I've had a feeling this week, I suspect a lot of people have had, I wish I had somehow in my time had a pint with Gerry Kiernan. And you know, what a remarkable man he seems to have been. I didn't know him at all. He was on the show once. We did a 15-minute chat about athletics one time or other, but I didn't know him. Eamon Sweeney, one of many this week to have penned a glowing tribute to what Kiernan represented on the track and off the track. There was a real greatness about Gerry Kiernan, greatness and honesty and enthusiasm. We really will miss him, is how he finishes the piece. He begins it by saying, Gerry Kiernan has two things above all. He was an honest man and he was an enthusiast. Those qualities seem essential for a world-class roadrunner. All those punishing miles leave no room for self-deception. They must know exactly what they're capable of and must love what they're doing, or the demands would just become unbearable. And he paints a picture of Kiernan very much in keeping with the ones we've heard all week. Tommy, anything jump out to you about Eamon's piece on Kiernan?
The stuff about Eamon's, Gerry Kiernan this week has been, you know, really, I mean, it's dreadfully so sad when the news broke just a couple of days ago. The tributes have just been so beautiful. You know, I think anybody should dig out Kieran McGeehan's interview with you guys a few days ago. Sean McGoldrick has a kind of a, you could say it's a bit of a encapsulation of that piece, because he speaks to Kieran McGeehan just below Eamon's piece in the Sunday Indo, talking about how Gerry was a father figure to her, and it's just brilliant. It's actually worth digging out to the audio from the interview the other day about how he sat down with her, was so honest, and said, and you know, she had admitted earlier in the interview that like she just wanted someone to tell her what to do because her ankle was in bits and she didn't know if she was going to run again, and he said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with you. And he had that honesty that Eamon Sweeney said that I'm afraid myself that I might tell you the wrong thing, and you know, but something about that whole honesty about a personality that seemed to chime with athletes. And there's so many pieces. I know it's the Sunday papers we're looking at, but the Irish Times is a kind of a weekend sports section, so it's well worth. It's still in the shops today. The sports section yesterday had two great pieces. Ian O'Riordan's piece on him as a coach, and also a piece about him as a teacher, which is written by somebody called Fergus O'Farrell, who was obviously a past pupil of St. Bridget's Boys School, and his stories about the approach to teaching that Gerry had. You know, he was a maverick. The curriculum didn't always suit him, so he'd often go off-piste for geography. He expounded on the Aegean and Adriatic seas, drawing on Greek mythology to bring imagery and drama to the lesson. Can you imagine being a student in that class? And he would task the kids with finding out the meaning of a difficult word. And if you were successful, he would give you a T-shirt he'd worn the previous week at a road race, or had won the previous week at a road race or a track meet. Once we had to find out the antonym for Orient. In the days before the internet, it was pretty hard for 12-year-olds to figure out that it's Occident. But half a dozen boys came back with the correct answer. We all wanted that T-shirt. And the last line, if you ever come across someone who went to St. Bridget's Cornell's Court, ask them who the best teacher they ever had was. 10 out of 10 will say Mr. Kiernan. Yeah. So again, just I think a lot of the pieces about what, you know, Kieran McGeehan said something in her interview that like he changed her life. And, you know, look, not all of us would be like George and have the honour to live on in eternity thanks to our words, but someone like Gerry Kiernan is clearly going to have impacted people's lives. And Kieran McGeehan said that, you know, she wants to coach herself and give something back now when she finishes in the way that Gerry did. And, you know, it's, again, as I said, very sad, but really a really rounded person and a person with such depth and a multitude. You know that old Walt Whitman line of, you know, the man contained multitudes. Well, Gerry Kiernan, certainly reading all the tributes over the week, certainly was that.
Yeah, you put that beautifully.
He was very much a... Sorry, Tommy and Joe. He was very much a human being. You know, there were so many sides to Jerry. Jerry wanted the best out of everything that he did. He wanted to enjoy it to the full. He wanted to maximize his potential. Eamon Sweeney makes the point in terms of his athletic career and how he ran. I knew him quite well as a panelist in our programs, and I would have met him from time to time. And one of the places I met him, funny enough, was in Barcelona Airport, because he was a great fan of Barcelona Football Club, as well as having the connections with Lake Garda in Italy. And the thing about Jerry was, if it was a big game and he could get to it at all, he would, because that was just, it was there and he wanted to be at it. And that was Jerry. He wanted to be involved in everything he could be involved in. He wanted to live life to the full. And he pretty much did. And he took great delight in everything. Again, another point that Eamon Sweeney made in his piece, he took as much delight in somebody winning an Irish title as in somebody winning an Olympic gold medal, or John Tracy at the marathon in Los Angeles when Jerry himself finished a very commendable ninth. You know, that Jerry Kiernan wanted to get across how much dedication it took for somebody like Siobhan Evison to win an Irish national title than somebody winning an Olympic title. It was a major, major, major achievement. And Jerry saluted that. And I love the way he did. And we did Fallulah Britain, Fallulah McCormick and the European cross countries. And Jerry took such great pleasure out of that, because here was the girl from Kilcool who had risen to the very top. And Jerry just loved the fact that had happened. And she became the first to retain that title in the way that she did. He was a great guy, and he lived his sport and he loved his sport, and it's terribly sad he's gone.
Yeah. So what kind of company was he, George, if you were sitting around having a cup of coffee?
It might have been a cup of coffee. I'll tell you something I probably shouldn't tell you. From the Barcelona airport store when we bumped into him, he had a glass of wine in front of him at 11 in the morning. And I said, Jerry, that's a bit early to get started. Jerry said, I cannot stand flying. And the only way I could get on a plane is with two glasses of Merlot inside me. He was a human being.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way.
I think like most of us obviously knew him as the pundit. So the analyst, as George said, over so many years, brilliant analyst. And somebody who wouldn't be, like, athletics wouldn't be my first sport. You know, it might be something I'd only come to at the big championships. He'd the great. I always say there's two key criteria for an analyst or pundit, if you like, to have, is to have something to say and to be able to say it. And like Jerry Kiernan always struck me as having that. So he had that ability to bring in the people who maybe weren't the athletics fans, tell them what this race, what was going to happen, who the people that were most important to look out for, what would likely play out, and afterwards explain what had happened, who had done well, who had underperformed, and you know, just a brilliant analyst in that sense. And as Eamon Sweeney says, sincerity was accompanied by considerable intelligence. No pundit was as resistant to the idea of dumbing down. His analysis was not just accurate, it was also articulate and literate to an extent which sport could be spoken about as intelligently as anything else. He must have been a terrific teacher.
Yeah, he really was a stunningly good pundit. He was one of those that just silenced the room if there were several people watching together. If he was talking, everybody stopped and watched. You know, he's in that bracket, and there are a few we could all name who are, and he most certainly was. On the GAA thing, because I always thought he was totally right about the GAA thing. You know, like it was this thing. So he said that not all GAA players are as fit as Olympians. Like, it was just so patently true. He said, Eamon Sweeney makes the point, sure, like, it's obvious. Look at the gap between Dublin and that of every other county. But Sweeney says, I remember getting an email from an old neighbour in Kerry who said he was fed up seeing people claim Jerry was biased against Gaelic games because he'd probably been no good at them. Whereas the email said he was a terrific footballer as a youngster. He just preferred running. So that was kind of an interesting point to make. That piece in the Irish Times yesterday was gorgeous as well. I read it. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. You could almost taste, Tommy, the atmosphere in the classroom as Kiernan awoke the passion for learning that people naturally have, and the competitive instinct, and who's going to find the adonym for Orient. Now, I had to search what an adonym was yesterday. I was like, what's an adonym?
Antonym.
Yeah, there you go. So this is, and I'm like, geez, Kiernan, thank you. I need, you know, that's my word for the weekend to nail down. And God, what a classroom to be a part of.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, it's Dead Poets Society territory.
Yes.
And it comes back to what I said about, there's actually a really nice piece, there's been a lot, it's more last week's story now, about Eamon Ryan, the Cork ladies football legendary coach who passed away last week, with Shane McGrath in the Mail. It tied into his sort of impact in the development of women's sport in general. But it struck me reading and listening to the stuff about Gerry this week, is that a bit like Eamon Ryan, somebody whose impact went way beyond the narrow confines between the sideline, you know, impact on people's lives, on them as on the whole people, and the classroom stuff. It's worth digging out that piece from the Times yesterday. Yeah. You know, it is, as you say, you can just imagine yourself being enthralled by this. Imagine sixth class boy, is, you know, brilliant.
Yes. Stuff. Hands in the air. Sir. That kind of a vibe. Yeah. We'll take a very short break. We're going to pick things up with George Hamilton and Tommy Martin. Now, you're welcome back. So we're reviewing the Sunday papers here on Sundays Off the Ball. Delighted to say we have George Hamilton with us and Tommy Martin as well. Tom is listening and he's out for his walk. He says, lads, give me that opposite of Orient business again, please. Antonym. See, I would have said opposite as well. I've got to be honest. I wouldn't have been an antonym man, but I'm going to try and become one. The antonym to Orient is occident, O-C-C-I-D-E-N-T, occident, which is a great word. That was new on me. Occident.
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 Am I right, George?
Occident. Yeah, occident. Occident.
Was that new on you, or did you all know that?
I do crosswords, Joe. Yeah, it's a great way to find words that you would never find otherwise.
Yes. I must start, because that was new on me. So there we go.
Don't beat
yourself
up.
It's allowed.
Look, listen, no one knows everything. Gerry Kiernan's still teaching. So there's some really great pieces. People can get stuck into them. Let's turn to the horse racing situation, because this is very serious this week. And others, Paul Kimmage, David Walsh, are raising bigger questions as well. The short version of this week, because I know people are so busy and hell, there's COVID every 5 minutes. It's hard to keep on top of everything. Charles Burns is a trainer who has won at Cheltenham in the past. He's a big name, and he's been banned for 6 months and fined €1,000, in effect because his horse, Viking Horde, is the name of the horse, tested positive for a sedative at Tramore Racecourse back in October 2018. It seemed that the horse ran conspicuously badly, said the report, and the rider gave it a reminder after the first jump, and it became rapidly detached from the rest of the field. And so there was a test carried out. The A sample came back positive. Charles Burns requested a B sample. A sample tested in the UK, B sample in France. Both were positive for a sedative. And in fact, the concentration of the sedative in Viking Horde system was 100 times the legal limit. And the written judgment in the case made the point that the horse was subject to a dangerous degree of sedation, put the safety of the horse, the rider, and the other horses at risk. And then the betting pattern, very significant here. Viking Horde started the day at 4-1, drifted out to a starting price of 8-1. And there were some substantial bets placed on the horse to lose. One in particular, €34,889, all to win €3,200. And there were other betting patterns when it came to Viking Horde and other races as well, like, for instance, Sedgefield in October, €30,279 to win €12,000, and it drifted that day in the betting as well. In effect, it was impossible for anybody to prove with certainty who had nobbled the horse. So in this instance, Charles Burns was found guilty of failing to supervise his horse at all times at Tramore, hence the 6-month suspension of his licence and the fine of €1,000. And he is appealing that case. So Paul Kimmage is writing about the big picture. Eamon Sweeney, cheating is part of who we are, is the headline on his piece. David Walsh on the back page of the Sunday Times. A case involving a doped horse and suspicious betting patterns leaves Irish racing facing some difficult governance questions. The thrust, George, of David Walsh's piece is he harks back to an investigation in 2014 where ultimately the lack of CCTV cameras at Punchestown meant that the case reached a bit of a dead end, and it was very hard to deduce how a horse had lost its shoes. That was in 2014, and fast forward to where we are now. And he makes the point, without CCTV cameras in Tramore, there was no way of checking what third parties had entered Viking Horde's box that day. 4 years after the lack of CCTV had an impact on the investigation into Fox Rocks' two missing shoes, the same issue in this case would affect the investigation. 26 racecourses in Ireland, and 7 years after the Fox Rock case, the only track with CCTV, for instance, is Leopardstown, and there have been some big track developments in the meantime.
Yeah, and the line that David uses at the end of the Fox Rock element of his piece is that one might have thought that the Turf Club would since have taken action to rectify this, but obviously, if they haven't, and there's only CCTV at Leopardstown, there hasn't been a will to pursue this as a means of keeping track on what is going on. And obviously then there's been another case has come up, and we just don't know, because we're not privy to what goes on behind the scenes, and everywhere else has got CCTV. And in the interest of fair play, would it not help if there was CCTV? Be interesting to hear the argument to say that there shouldn't be CCTV, or why they haven't tried to have it installed. Because as I say, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Like they made the joke about where I used to work in Belfast at the BBC when they built a big new extension. And this was in the early 1970s, of course, and it was inspired, this development was inspired by the troubles that were on at the time, that the BBC in Belfast had more television cameras outside than it had inside, because it was all CCTV. So the concept of CCTV has been around since the 70s and maybe even before. And here we are 50 years later, and the big money, government-funded horse racing industry in Ireland has only got one of its 26 racecourses with CCTV cameras in it. Why?
Hmm. Yeah, and Walsh points out the Curra, the new redevelopment there, €81 million spent on the redevelopment at the Curra, €36 million of which, by the way, taxpayer money, and the cost of installing CCTV would have been €20,000, and it wasn't spent. And in the UK, every single racecourse obliged to have CCTV, Tommy.
Yeah, I think that's that really jumps out. You know, there's a few things like that. There's the fact that every racecourse in the UK is obliged to have CCTV, whereas only one in Ireland has. There's also some information that, you know, Paul Kimmage's piece deals with the whole issue, the issue of Omerta, which he's, of course, very well qualified to write about. And
The Walsh piece finishes, by the way, with this little paragraph here. Leading trainer Jim Bulger believes doping is a problem in Irish racing. Many agree with Bulger, though they are reluctant to say so publicly. There is also a belief in Irish racing, held by many in a position to know, that within the past 5 years, a favourite for one of the handicaps at Cheltenham was stopped. This is at the Cheltenham Festival. No sedative was necessary, just a jockey doing as he was told. That's a hell of a paragraph to finish on, George. And that's almost the theme of Eamon Sweeney's piece as well. Cheating is a part of who we are. And he says, racing fans are more ambivalent about betting skullduggery than fans of any other sport.
I suppose it's in the nature of things that, leaving aside the suggestion that cheating is part of what we are, I think being in the know is part of what we are. And in horse racing, in any kind of racing, I suppose, greyhound racing as well, a punter likes to think that they know more than the next guy so that they can get one up on the bookie and make a bit of a killing. And so there is perhaps the potential for more of a nudge, wink, wink in that sort of circumstance. Whereas if you're betting on football matches, it's a different kind of thing because there is so much more out in the open, and at the top level, everything is so scrutinized that it would be very difficult to manufacture situations where there might be some wrongdoing that might go unnoticed. But in the world of, I'm almost tempted to say, cash money in the old way, where there were no tracks and traces and things, I suppose it can be very difficult to keep track of things. And as I say, in terms of the technology not being there, it's almost suggesting that there's a willingness not to keep track of things, which is maybe part of the problem.
Yeah, and it's one that racing will have to get on top of. Tommy, you were mentioning, I think just as we lost you there, I think it was Paul Kimmage's piece, which is inside, it's on page 5. The nightmare begins, he says, and he mentions Lance Armstrong would never have prospered without the enablers, and so it is with racing. What did you take from Paul's piece today?
Well, look, I think it's good to get the, if you haven't really been on top of this story, the Kimmich piece, the David Walsh piece in the Sunday Times, and the Eamon Sweeney piece are a nice rounded view of it. The David Walsh has been on this for the last few months with different questions and really serious questions that Irish racing needs to get on top of. I think the Sweeney one is really important because, as George says, you know, there's always been an element of, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I've got a bit of info from the horse's mouth here. And Sweeney kind of teases out how, where is the line where that bit of Dick Francis skullduggery veers into genuine wrongdoing. And then the Kimmich piece, as you can imagine, from his track record, deals with the Omerta side of it and then lays out all the different instances. And just coming back to the issue of the CCTV not being in place in Irish courses as opposed to the UK, you know, one of the cases he mentions is talking about the difference in the rate of positive tests between Ireland and the UK. Based on the numbers released by the British Horse Racing Authority and the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board, an Irish trained horse was 4.7 times more likely to test positive for a banned substance in 2018 than his UK counterpart. If the comparison is restricted to national hunt racing in that year, an Irish trained horse was 8.9 times more likely to test positive than a British rival. So, and these are being tested by the same lab, because I think it was, I only found this out during the week, it might have been on your own program, Joe, that the testing was moved from an Irish lab to be centralized Newmarket a few years ago.
Yeah.
So it's all been tested, all been analyzed, sorry, in the same lab in Newmarket. So multiple times more likely an Irish horse is to show up a positive test. What are the reasons for that? What is racing doing about it? The question I think all this comes to a head is, racing needs to grip the nettle on this, grasp the nettle on this, take this issue, be really lead from the front on it in terms of the big people in racing. You know, Jim Bolger has come out and said this is an issue. Jim Bolger, one of the biggest names in Irish racing, most respected trainers, has come out and said there is a problem here. Where is the stampede of other big figures, big owners, big trainers, big breeders to come out and say, yes, we need to be squeaky clean because racing in Ireland is hugely important. It's a huge tradition, huge for the economy, huge for the rural economy. And it's an area where we've been market leaders. Come out and don't say things like show us the evidence. Come out and be the absolute market leaders, world leaders on this, because it's that important to answer these questions for the sport in this country.
Yes, because Paul Kimmich quotes Brian O'Connor of the Irish Times back in December, George, and makes the point on Bulger, who said that doping was the number one problem in the sport. And Brian O'Connor said back in December, just imagine if Brian Cody said performance-enhancing drugs were rife in hurling, or Leo Cullen claimed Leinster rugby weren't competing on level playing field due to doping. The impact would be seismic, the public debate all-consuming. But in racing, not a bit of it. 6 weeks later, and rather than sound and fury, there's been little more than silence. And he says, true to form, a sport and industry has obeyed its instincts and hunkered down to ride out the storm. I get the impression, George, that this storm isn't going away and the spotlight is firmly on the sport now.
Yeah, I would be of that opinion as well, because it's, Kimmage's piece also refers to the dinger that was written in the Irish Field about this, that, you know, it's something that is in the public domain now, very much in the public domain, and the fact that there's a case under appeal is keeping it in the public domain. I think, you know, it's possibly understandable that people don't like dirty linen being washed in public, but by the same token, as Tommy has said, it is such an important part of the fabric of Irish, not only Irish sporting life, but Irish life, that it needs to be right. I think that's the top and bottom of it. And I think, you know, Paul Kimmage and David Walsh have a track record in getting it right and taking their investigations in the correct direction. So your point is well made. This is not going to go away.
Just to add on to the sort of a concluding piece from David Walsh on it, he's obviously explored the Viking Horde case and the Fox Rock case in his piece, but he ends it by referring to Jim Bulger's comments. So leading trainer Jim Bulger believes doping is a problem in Irish racing. Many agree with Bulger, though they are reluctant to say so publicly. There is also a belief in Irish racing held by many in a position to know that within the past 5 years, a favourite for one of the handicaps at the Cheltenham Festival was stopped. No sedative was necessary, just a jockey doing as he was told. Now, if faith, it's one thing, faith in a small race in Tramore being broken, and that's very serious. But if faith in the Cheltenham Festival is in question here, then, you know, this, then they do have a problem.
Yeah. When your line froze, I read the exact same paragraph that jumped out to me as well. I mean, that's now being printed in national newspapers here and in the UK. You know, it's getting very serious. So, to matters less complicated, although they concern you both, I suspect. Page 77 of the Mail. George, I know you picked this out. UEFA to outline own plan for elite. So there's a tug of war at the moment, George. There were plans for a Super League, and we've been hearing about these for 20, 30 years at this stage, but it seems to be gathering pace. Yep. Plans for a Super League, 15 teams, closed shop, £310 million just to join, another 200 plus million a season. Real Madrid, Juventus, Barcelona to the fore, they're inviting the English clubs. UEFA are trying to respond.
Yeah. There's a very powerful piece, funny enough, powerful is the word in the headline, talk about kind of a process of association here, by Sam Wallace of The Telegraph in England, which is syndicated to the Sunday Independent. It's just underneath the Paul Kimmage piece on page 5. And he outlines what's going on here, which is men in suits, very powerful, wealthy men in suits, are trying to increase their revenue and influence within the small coterie of the 15 big teams, and to hell with football as we know it. There was something on Twitter yesterday, which was a picture I saw of a Nottingham Forest fan beside a banner which said, doesn't matter who has the key to our club, it still belongs to us. And this is what Sam Wallace is saying. And he's also drawing attention to the fact that behind the suggestion of Project Big Picture, where the Premier League clubs were going to offer trickle-down money to the lower divisions, this is all predicated upon the fact that the Premier League is going to lose income because the TV rights will all be swallowed up by this big new European Super League. So when Project Big Picture, which involves a trickle-down of money to smaller clubs, comes into being, these guys are betting on the fact that they won't, in fact, have a big pot to trickle down out of because the Premier League rights will have diminished. And if that is the case, I mean, all the domestic leagues across Europe are going to suffer because of this if it ever comes to pass, which I personally doubt it will, because UEFA, I haven't answered your question as to what they're proposing. They're going to revamp the Champions League from 2024, which we may get to discuss in a moment. But I think the point is that Sam Wallace says a relentless serving of Bayern Munich against Benfica from here to eternity is not what the football paying fan wants. And the thrust of his piece is how many people actually want this Super League? And it's the 200 or so big men in suits with big wallets. They're the ones who want it. And the millions of football fans across the nations don't. And I might just end this particular statement, if you like, by drawing a comparison with what it was like when I did a year in Germany as an English language teacher. And I followed the football. I was based in the Ruhr. Bayern Munich, who are now cast iron certainties to win the Bundesliga every year. What's that for competition? Bayern Munich, I was at the game where they lost the Bundesliga when they needed to win, and they were beaten by a team called MSV Duisburg. And they lost 2-0. It was all in place that they were going to win the league, but they didn't that day. They lost it, and Mönchengladbach won the league. Where are Mönchengladbach now? Well, they beat Dortmund the other night, but they're not challenging Bayern Munich. Dortmund aren't even challenging Bayern Munich. Who is challenging? Leipzig. Leipzig, with all their money, are the team that are challenging Bayern Munich. And so if that's the way it's going, the fans are just going to melt away because it won't be the game that they followed. And it's sad. But as I say, I don't think it'll come to pass because UEFA, very, very, very aware of where the money might end up, will want to hold on to it themselves and the control of it themselves. And they're going to revamp the Champions League, it said, from 2024, according to the Mail on Sunday, with a different kind of Champions League that will retain the latter stages of the competition as it is, but will revamp it at the start on a rather complicated seeding system so as to have more matches and end up with a better competition.
Yeah, what they're planning for 2024 is 36 teams. Teams will play 10 games in what's known as the Swiss system, first device for a chess tournament in Switzerland, against opponents of varying strengths based on seeding. So you'll play your 10 games, and then the top 12 teams will go to last 16, with another four slots being settled with playoffs, and then on they go to knockout stages. So 10 games in the group stages, so something akin to a league. Tommy, I don't know, do you like the sound of that in 2024?
The thing is, I think it's irrelevant whether we like the sound of it or not, because there's forces that are shaping football and have been shaping professional football for the last 30 odd years, which don't really care what we think and don't really care what the fans think. I mean, it was Silvio Berlusconi sat watching Real Madrid play Napoli in the 1989 European Cup first round and couldn't understand why you had two of the biggest teams in Europe and one of them was going to be knocked out of the competition in September, when he could sell, you know, on his TV company, he could sell, you know, subscriptions and cable packages till the cows come home if he could have this every week. So he was one of the, you know, that's where it all sort of started, and the Champions League and Premier League, and 35 years later, here we are. This competition, what's going on here, to my mind, over the last couple of years and over the last decade or so, is constant game of brinksmanship between the leading European clubs and UEFA. So every time UEFA renew the structure of the Champions League, the leading clubs, the European Club Association, threaten to break away, and UEFA, in turn, to keep them happy, give them a little bit more. So the most recent Champions League, the one format we're under now, none of the top five leagues have to play qualifying rounds. They all get automatic places. There's less room for the teams from so-called smaller countries, et cetera, and a bigger slice of the financial pie. So every few years you get this, brinksmanship goes on, and this is just the latest installment. And because this plan by the big clubs has gone so far this time, UEFA are clearly feeling that they have to come back with something really revolutionary, and this single 36-team league. And what it's going to do is shift the balance less away from domestic leagues, more of these elite, so-called elite games that, you know, Sam Wallace talks about, the Bayern Munich against Benfica. And the idea is weakening the domestic leagues. The longer game being, all these big clubs want to have a situation where European soccer is a bit like the NFL, where it's a massive 400 million population market, big clubs in all the big cities, and they carve up the spoils, and in 30 years time we might be vaguely remembering things like the FA Cup and, you know, the League Cup and things like that would be distant history.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, the 2024 Champions League situation sounds miserable to me. 10 game season before they even get into knockouts. Like, we're currently at what, 3-2? We're currently at 6 group games. That's plenty for me to go back to 10. I mean,
hey, listen, if it keeps me in gainful employment,
I'm sure you're about to bring back 2 group stages, says Hamilton.
Yes, absolutely.
More than
no,
better.
Tommy's right. There's nothing anybody's going to be able to do about this, because big bucks are going to talk at the end of the day. And what we're seeing are the two bulldozers getting ready to charge at each other, the Super League on one side and UEFA on the other. And UEFA has managed to retain the upper hand by adjusting its product over the years, and will probably do so on this occasion. But I would foresee what Tommy foresees as well, which is the Americanization of European Association football. And goodness knows where that will leave the League of Ireland.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's another point as well. So, Tommy, you wanted to mention Tom Brady.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention it. It's actually, just to harp back again to yesterday's Irish Times, where Keith Duggan had a really good piece about Tom Brady in it. Well worth having a look at if you can. There's just a little piece in the Sunday Times by Josh Glancy today, who's their Washington correspondent, I think. It's not particularly a standing piece. It's kind of a lot of rehashing a lot of the same stuff about Brady that we know, but I'm definitely going to sit down and watch this tonight, because I really hit me. I was there reading this morning, and he says, I'll pause for a moment here and ask all the 43-year-olds out there reading this over a hearty breakfast. Hello, 43-year-old reading it over a hearty breakfast. To put themselves in Brady's shoes, imagine picking up a ball and running at a wall of five monstrous 300-pound gym fanatics, most of them 2 decades younger than you, determined to crush your bones into powder. Imagine you've already got $100 million in the bank and 6 Super Bowl rings and a property portfolio to rival Donald Trump. Imagine still wanting more. Brady's resolve borders on the manic. Now, as a 43-year-old who it took all my resolve to go out and get the papers this morning, it's quite a testament to the guy. So I'll definitely tune in this evening.
Above that, by the way, it's a brilliant read. I think it's one of the best reads of the weekend. Peter Riley, Ross McCarron. I suspect somewhere along the way, Ross must have told his story before, but I don't remember it in too much depth. McCarron is the guy who walked away from Leinster. You know, he had the offer of a contract there, or certainly had a year left in his contract, and just it wasn't for him. 23 years of age. This was in 08, just as Leinster were on the verge of conquering Europe, says Peter O'Reilly. And Peter, by the way, as a tangent, given where we're headed in sport generally and the finances involved, his story should be of particular interest to the 90 or so rugby players whose agents are presently in contractual negotiations with the IRFU and David Nusafora, because according to sources, the budget for players' salaries is down by 20% on last season. No 3-year deals are being offered, and if you're lucky enough to be offered a 2-year deal, the second season comes with a non-negotiable COVID clause attached, which gives the union an opt-out clause if crowds are below 75% capacity by 2022 Six Nations. Try getting a mortgage with a 1-year contract as your only security. So that's the current state of play. But McCarron is 36 now, really good prospect, Gonzaga, Irish schools, Leinster Academy, Irish under-19s, Irish under-21s. There's a Keith Gleeson try against Ospreys on YouTube, January 07, where you'll see him. And as Mark Robson, the commentator, says, I'll tell you what, there's some cracking youngsters coming through this Leinster side when you look at McCarron, Sexton and Kearney. That was his second game, he tells Peter O'Reilly. Michael Checa was the coach then. He says, Checa gave out to me for not feeding Dennis Hickey to my right. That was his unique way of doing things, giving out to you even when you'd done something good. And he talks about Checa being school of hard knocks. When you were injured, it was not a good place to be. You were self-conscious. It drained on your confidence. Checa was not exactly giving you high fives when you passed him in the corridor if you were injured. And it all came to a head after a game against Glasgow where he didn't play that well. And Checa told him he wanted him to sit down and write down everything he had done badly. And Ross McCarron thinks to himself, I'm thinking, F this, I'm supposed to be playing a game tomorrow. I don't want all the confidence knocked out of me by writing down all the things I'd done wrong. So he jumped in the car with a few lads to get some lunch. And in the car, he sent his girlfriend a text just slaughtering Checa and how he says himself, it was a brutal text message. This guy's an idiot. I hate him, etc. I was on an old Nokia, which prompted me to send the text to my most recent contact, Michael Checa. I pressed OK by mistake. I'll never forget that feeling. My heart dropped to the bottom of my stomach. The lads came back into the car. I was white as a sheet. I told them what I'd done. And one of them, I won't say who, says, where's Checa now? He was training with the seniors. Then he says, where's his phone? We headed back to Riverview as quickly as we could. The tension. My friend kept lookout. I burst into Checa's office. I found his phone under some papers. It said, one new message. Sender, Ross McCarron. That was the one message he never received. and crisis averted. But ultimately, he walked away. He said, I was virtually verging on depressed with all the injuries. A jaw injury. It felt like Checa couldn't trust me. Fitzgerald Kearney coming through, and he walked away to the shock of his dad, his girlfriend, but a massive weight off my shoulders at 23. Really interesting, George.
Yeah, I found that a fascinating piece because I'd completely forgotten that he was in that league with the Johnny Sextons and the Rob Kearney, that he was a coming man, and he'd gone. So much has happened since. But, you know, He also makes the point to how bad he felt when they were winning the Heineken Cup, and he wasn't part of it. These were the guys he played with, and how upset at the time he was. But now he's happy that he did what he did. He finished his education. He got himself into a good job. He's into a better job now, and his little boy's now at the Lansdowne Mini Rugby. So the wheel has turned full circle. And maybe it'll be even more full circle by the time that little boy gets to be playing senior rugby, because the point you made at the start there, the point that Peter O'Reilly makes at the start, and I have been wondering about this in the circumstances, whether professional rugby in the times that we're in, and that's very stark, isn't it? When you, Rob Kearney's gone to Australia, the other guys are negotiating contracts, 92 of them looking for contracts, and they're not really going to get much satisfaction. It's a terrible place to be in, but it's you know, Ross McCarron has come out of it well in the end, because he took a decision way back then. Professional sports, not at the elitist of elite levels, is a difficult place to be in these days.
And that seemed to be his thinking, Tommy. Like, do I want to be a journeyman here and suddenly be looking to start a new life at the age he is now, which is 36 or so? Although you can imagine, as George referenced, he said, one day in the office, a motivational speaker came to the office. He's shown us pictures of Leinster with the Heineken Cup. And I do remember at that point thinking, this is seriously grim.
I think it's a really wistful piece, you know. Or it's not coming out and saying, I'd never regret it for a moment. Clearly, some of the quotes, he's got little pangs of, did I make the right decision? You know, he mentions that situation where he's sitting watching his mates lifting the Heineken Cup. Then he says at the end, you know, did I make the right decision leaving Leinster? There's no doubt it was the right thing for me to do at the time. Maybe I should have looked into another province when there was that opportunity. But having said that, I'm very happy where I am now. There's just a lovely little light and shade there between, you know, he probably can't help looking back and thinking, maybe I should have. But then at the time, I was sure I wanted to. And it's something we can all relate to. Maybe we all look back at moments and kind of gone, was that the right thing to do then? And, you know, it's just a really kind of human story. It's not the story of the guy who bounced back and won the cup. You know, or sometimes you read stories about guys who nearly gave it up but stuck at it and won, you know, became a champion. This guy kind of just went off into obscurity, and it's just an interesting tone to the piece.
Totally, it's a complicated tone. I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much if he had said it was definitely the right decision, no regrets whatsoever.
How can he know?
You know, and that's for all of us. A question for you both, George. If you weren't in the media, what would you be doing?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm coming from straight out of left field. I have no idea what to say. I think I might well have gone traveling in some capacity or other. And I might have ended up back in that classroom teaching in Germany.
Yeah. Tommy Martin?
God, I haven't a clue. Well, I did have a proper job. I was the guy in the office where Ross McCarron was and left it for the... Not exactly.
Bright lights.
Yeah, I was going to say, not particularly lucrative, not particularly glamorous, but much more enjoyable world than I'm in now. So.
Right. What office job were you in? I never talked to you about that before.
Yeah, I worked after I left college. I did an arts degree. I did a degree in history and politics. So obviously I was going to go and work in a bank after that. it was sort of Celtic Tiger time, and worked in sort of finance and banking for a few years, and eventually decided that my talents were wanted elsewhere than the world of international commerce.
And was it a life is too short, this is boring approach? Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I always remember sitting at my desk, looking out the window, going, thinking that my life was happening somewhere else. It wasn't happening here. You know, I just real kind of out of body experience, and you know, I had to. And I was kind of one of those people who was like, yeah, I work in the bank, but really what I want to do is this. And then I realized I was becoming, I needed to actually do something about it. So, you know, it was one of those kind of jump, make the leap now or
forever.
Piss or get off the pot.
Yeah, forever hold your peace, yeah. I think Dave McIntyre was the same banking as well, and he thought this ain't happening.
Banking's loss.
Well, indeed, indeed. One last quick piece or two to mention. The ban and beyond, Dennis Walsh, page 14 of the Sunday Times. I think everyone's pretty familiar with the ban. Rule 27, in existence for more than 60 years, and just throws in a few anecdotes of the ban in effect. Kicks off with the famous one of Liam Brady at 15 going off to play for Ireland against Wales, and he was a pupil in St. Aidan's, a Christian Brothers school, and he went off anyway, and they threatened expulsion. It wasn't an idle threat, and then from page of the Evening Herald a few days later, Christian Brother expels boy for playing soccer. and the head brother issued a denial in the paper, but the sanction stood. And we have Shay Given's father, I hadn't realised, George, Seamus Given. So he was sneaking in and out of soccer matches in Donegal, changing in a car and effectively being smuggled in and out, as was Brian McAniff as well.
Yeah, they were strange times back then, of course. My dear late colleague Jimmy McGee had a great yarn when he was still living on the Cooley Peninsula and the countryside, and he would catch the bus and he would hide his football boots because he was going to play football, association football, as opposed to Gaelic football. And he was at the bus stop, awaiting the bus with his boots in a paper bag so that it wouldn't be known where he was headed. But there was this elderly neighbour, a lady, leaning over the gate who knew fine well where he was headed. And he said, "There you go now, McGee, there you go again. Off to play your soccer." Jimmy used to love telling that story. Those were the days when he worked in a day job before he took the leap into broadcasting. But yeah, no, he got great mileage out of that story.
Tralee Dynamos mentions Dennis here to give you a little sense of the atmosphere. The only soccer team in Kerry, they played in the Limerick League. In the last years of the ban, so I think the ban ended in 71. The last years of the ban, they suffered their share of harassment. Every so often, broken glass would be spread in their pitch on the night before a home match, and a couple of times their goalposts were sawed down. It was vandalism by a mindless few touting the GAA as their badge. And then as soon as the ban lifted, suddenly eight teams mushroomed up because there was an interest there, Tommy.
The anecdotes, obviously, you mentioned the Liam Brady one and Brian McAniff is mentioned as well, are quite well known. But it's a really enjoyable piece to have them sort of explored a bit more. But the Seamus Given one, it kind of illustrates a sort of a wacky races kind of cannonball run type atmosphere around playing soccer at the time. So Given was playing inter-county football with Donegal at the time. There was no soccer league in Donegal, but in towns and villages around the county, there was a thriving calendar of summer cup competitions. So one August evening, when Given was having his dinner, a priest arrived at his door in convoy, accompanied by Liam McGlinchey from the local garage. Arranmore Island had reached the final of the convoy cup, but their goalkeeper was stuck at sea on a fishing vessel and they needed an instant solution. Given agreed to play on condition that he could be smuggled in and out of the ground without being seen. So he togged out at home and climbed into the boot of a Ford Cortina Mark II. Arranmore won, scooping the first prize of £700, and Given was man of the match. He left the same way he had arrived, hidden like a stowaway. But it's interesting, just there's a great line from Brian McAniff, who played for Cork Hibs in the League of Ireland under an assumed name. I mean, like, honestly, obviously it was probably well known at the time, but as Dennis Walsh writes, suspending somebody like McAniff, who was Donegal's best player at the time, simply wouldn't have been in their best interests. Eventually the ban is overturned, and then McAniff quits soccer. He says, "I think when the ban went, the fun went out of it too." So it's kind of a it's kind of mad.
It's like an affair.
Yeah, there you go.
Dear, okay. Dennis Walsh, page 17 of the Times. We're pretty much out of time. I'm going to mention this briefly, and then I might ask you both for a thought on any Liverpool United pieces that grabbed you. But people are interested in what's going on in Kilkenny at the moment. So Colin Fenley is gone. Dennis Walsh, very well sourced journalist often, and he's saying it is known that there were tensions between Colin Fenley and Brian Cody during last year's championship. The first training session after the Liverpool final, Cody took Fenley and Walter Welch to one side, reportedly gave them a piece of his mind. Fenley was then on the bench for the Waterford game. He came on when there was a point in it, didn't do anything to turn the tide. Obviously, there's no reason or statement given on Fenley's behalf as to why he's taken just the year out. But later on, Dennis Walsh writes, "For the first time, local confidence in Cody to bring Kilkenny back is not unanimous on the ground. On various wavelengths, the persistent word from Nolan Park is that Kilkenny's preparation is not as good as it needs to be," which is an interesting line. Last year's championship, they were on the end of a 16-point swing against Dublin, 14-point swing against Waterford. It's understood a recent approach was made to Henry Shefflin and Richie O'Neill to come on board as coaches. So a few bits and bobs happening behind the scenes there. I'm sure Brian Cody would point to a Leinster win against Galway and the semi-final win against Limerick the year before that is a sign that things are just fine. But rumblings of sorts on page 17 of the Sunday Times. Manchester United.
I just thought wanted to throw into the ring there the thought that every time I read about this about Brian Cody, I can't help thinking about Mickey Hart.
Yeah.
The parallels perhaps there in what happens when somebody's been so successful and so dominant in charge for so long. And quite possibly those underneath are not the same people who were there when they began. And there's a new kind of cadre of committee men and women who are maybe of a different mind. I don't know. It's just, I can't help seeing the parallel between Brian Cody and Mickey Hart.
Yeah, I could certainly drift more firmly into that dynamic if Cody stays on and these stories keep appearing. But I don't know, Tommy, like the Limerick semi-final 2 years ago, even the Leinster final win, just gone, and he's working with a lesser group, I think, without any disrespect intended. I mean, it's very easy to start grumbling and saying, what have you done for me lately, Brian?
I've seen this piece various guises over the last few weeks. It certainly seems to be the big talking point around the hurling world over this winter. And I don't think it's mentioned in this piece. Maybe I'm getting pieces mixed now, but I think it is actually. The whole issue of had this been a normal winter, then there may have been more of a push to make bigger changes. In other words, if Kilkenny had have been out of an All-Ireland in August, a long winter of time for somebody new to come in and change things. But now maybe it's kind of felt like, well, now is definitely not the right time to do anything if you're going to do anything. But certainly there seems to be, I've never seen this amount of, and it's all toned this way, rumblings, whispers. You know, it's like some Soviet dictator and the rest of the Politburo are, you know, are wondering if his time is up, but nobody's going to come out and go in the pages of Pravda and call for his head. So
yeah, and I think part of that, and it was, well, actually I'm basing this more on the Tyrone situation, is anyone who might be in the mix for the job had played under Hart in the main. And so they did not want to be the person who had pushed him out because of everything he had done for the county. And same with Cody. Do you want to be the person who's pushing Cody off? You know, that will be divisive and messy. So
Wants to be the Moyes to Cody's Ferguson?
That too. Anything in the United Liverpool coverage, George? Grab your eye.
I liked Souness in the Times suggesting that it's Liverpool's midfield that's the problem. You know, forget the lack of goals of the Van Dijk void. It's the engine room that Liverpool really need to fix. And he kind of puts his finger on the fact that Fabinho's had to fill in at the back and Thiago's been hurt. That's where the problem lies. That's what he sees as the problem being for Liverpool. And I also like the one about Manchester United have a plan in place. Did Alex Ferguson have a plan? I can't remember which paper I saw that one in. I think it might have been the Indo, wasn't it? Does Ole have a plan, or has he just ended up at the top by chance? I thought that was rather good.
That was, I think, the Jonathan Wilson piece, was it?
That's the one. Exactly the one, yeah. I've got my pages all mixed up here. I can't find it.
It's hard to keep track. The United thing is interesting because you get the sense of all the football analysts and writers and stuff scratching their heads, trying to figure out how United are top of the league, and you know, against everything that they were saying what, four, five, 6 weeks ago, that it doesn't seem to make sense, and maybe in this season nothing makes sense. And Jonathan Wilson, who's, you know, who literally wrote the book about tactics and philosophies in football, his piece in the Observer, which is syndicated in the Sunday Indo, is suggesting that maybe against modern trends, which say you have to have this very strict philosophy like Guardiola or Klopp have, maybe this season United, with a team that don't particularly have a strong particular philosophy in any specific way, they're doing well because, as he says, at United, meanwhile, as a club unwedded to a philosophy, the emphasis is far more on individuals and moments. The structures are less complex, the more traditional qualities of motivation and unity more important. That is contrary to the direction of most modern tactical thought, but this season it may prove an advantage. So yeah. I don't know whether that's...
I wasn't sure I even bought that. I don't know how Benitez and Houllier fitted into this great tradition at Liverpool. But anyway, it was interesting nonetheless. We got to go. Trevor texted in. I don't suspect you'd get an answer, Trevor. Who does George Hamilton support?
Oh, Arsenal.
Oh, do you? I saw you. You're allowed to be open about these things. Oh, okay, good.
No, I'm not allowed, but I'll do it anyway.
All right, good.
It's an open secret.
It's Arsenal. Okay. Why was that? Who hooked you in?
So I'm very... it's a family thing that goes right back to when I was a kid. And the family... Arsenal was in the family, and it seemed like the logical thing to do. And then they went and won the double. And why not? And so here I am suffering through this strange season.
Yeah.
While Manchester United and Liverpool go merrily on. But it just struck me listening there to the last joust there between the pair of you. The Champions League don't want the big teams to go out. Berlusconi didn't want the big teams to go out. The FA Cup's going to lose Manchester United or Liverpool.
Yeah. But at least it gives us something to watch this afternoon, so I'll take it.
That's absolutely right.
Fellas, listen, really enjoyed that. I've enjoyed this RTE Virgin Media Off the Ball news talk coming together. We will resume hostilities now. So, George Hamilton and Tommy Martin, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
Thank you.
So.
Bye.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.